Chris Denson, you guys, your host of Innovation Crush, here with Eric Bell. Say hello, Eric. Go ahead, drink your Coca-Cola. We're not sponsored by Coca-Cola. Just go ahead, drink
it. We should be, and it's a fantastic
beverage.
Yeah, it is. It's probably going to be illegal in California pretty soon, but I'm going to drink it.
Weed's legal, Coke is illegal. In case you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things ideas, creativity, innovation, really dope people doing really dope things. I'm enjoying this outfit. Why don't you walk us through this ensemble today?
Oh, we'll call it Coastal Cowboy.
Coastal Cowboy. I like that.
Yeah, it sounds like something out of like a bad B movie from the 80s with, you know, Freddie Mercury starring in it. No, you know, we all have to have a look, and it's stunning out in LA. So I figure, you know, swimwear everywhere.
Yeah, no,
all the time. No dress codes in this town, you know.
So that's very true.
It's fantastic, you know. There's nothing like putting, you know, Swedish trainers with French swimsuits and
a linen shirt and
a propane hat that talks about America but was made in China.
It's so Buster's Propane.
Buster's Propane. Shout out to Buster's Propane. They're going to trend so much harder than they ever have in history.
Exactly. We're trending on Twitter. All right. So, Real Talk, you are the founder, CEO, and president. And do I have all three of those titles?
So many titles
of Blue Duck Scooters.
Other people have titles too. It's not like I'm just accumulating them.
You're just the one person. I'm also head of accounting and the engineering team.
I'm a figurehead. They just keep giving me titles and I keep doing less, actually. So I recommend it, though. It's a good way to do it. So
it is. It sounds like it. Multiple titles, just different business cards for different occasions.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little, give us a little bit of the, you know, the origin story of an Eric Bell.
So you want to start on the business side of it, or you want to start on
We can start with Blue Duck, and then
we can expand out.
See? Okay. See how that works?
So
it's like orbiting the sun.
You know, there's a thing going on across the planet, which is, you know, a revolution in micromobility, which I apologize. When I say that, it puts me to sleep, too. So
I like the phrase.
Micromobility is a dumb phrase, but eventually someone's going to come up with a better one. It's not going to be me. We're the largest electric scooter sharing platform in Texas. We're the only company of note domestically. There's about six or seven of us in the scooter sharing space that's not based in California. Yet here we are in California today.
Yes.
So the
thanks for flying in just for this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. no, we're kind of positioning ourselves as the Southwest Airlines of the scooter business. We believe a few things, which is that scooter sharing platforms and mobility sharing platforms are going to be a part of the fabric of urban living for the full duration of our lives. We also believe that the world is like a pretty big place. We come from a big place, which is Texas, which it seems a long way away, but is an enormous state. And so our kind of strategic play is not trying to go and beat Bird in Santa Monica. That's like, seems pretty fucking dumb to us. Our play is to go and, you know, kind of conquer or, you know, take positions in territories that are really throughout the Southeast, what you would associate with like the SEC conference,
right,
if you will. So
right.
We're kind of like Texas first, Florida second, everything else in between. And we believe that that is in and of itself a incredible business. And we have some data points that suggest, and we're coming to truly believe, that micromobility doesn't just have the potential, but is very likely to be bigger than rideshare. And as we're seeing in the IPO process with Lyft and now with Uber, you know, rideshare is a big beast in this space.
You guys used a phrase, at least in some of your collateral, which is the last mile. Which I think about, like this idea, like, okay, I may have Ubered to a location, or I'm here and I just got that one little bit to go, or maybe I want to go from one restaurant to a game or something like that. Where's that sweet spot for scooter usage? Right? Where does it?
So
there's a couple of facets of this that we see in our markets. So there's like pure joyriding, which is usually like newer users, newer, younger users. Then there's markets, which we'll use because we're local to Santa Monica right here, that are very tourist driven. Santa Monica has 19,000 people, but it has millions of visitors every year that drive up and down or scoot up and down Ocean Boulevard all day long. And then there is where we think this space ultimately lands, which is much more of a commodity or a utility, which is, as we've seen from some market comparables, you know, Ford bought Spin for a pretty good valuation considering where Spin was at and their development cycle. And congrats to those guys. They're fantastic. But what we learned from that, or what we infer from that, is that Ford is smart enough to know that they're not in the automobile business anymore. They're in the transportation business, and having a play in the micromobility and the sharing space is where they're putting, you know, almost $500 million of cash from the acquisition cost to also what they committed to put into the company over a period of years. So from a development standpoint, the fact that automobile companies are, maybe scared is the wrong word, but they're at least paying attention and putting money on the table there, gives us a lot of confidence that that our assumptions about the growth in the space are going to be similar to the kind of growth profile that we saw in, you know, kind of 1.0 rideshare, which is people were like, we don't understand these valuations. They're too high. Who's ever going to use this? How are they going to build, you know, vertical and horizontal platforms? And then you kind of blink your eyes 5 years later, and you're looking at companies that are equivalently valued based off what people said could be possible 5 years ago. So that's kind of where we see the space today. And we think, you know, there's a lot of folks. Sorry to be folksy. I'm from Texas. No, so like,
I like it. Eric's from Texas. Just so you know, the other Eric.
There's a lot.
I don't know which
one
of you to call the real Eric.
There are so many folks in the space that are really focused on primary markets.
Right. And by folks, you mean companies, just for the audience.
Yeah. Texas. I mean, and I get I get like wanting to be in New York or London or whatever. Like, those are fine places too. But, we think a little differently about it. It's not meant to be like a Steve Jobs thing. It's just like we're actually thinking differently.
No, well, that was actually one of, you know, in our initial conversation, I love the fact that, you know, as a challenger brand, right, it wasn't like the names you hear most often, but your strategy and thinking as to how you differentiate from either, both from a locality standpoint as well as some of the business ingenuity you've
mentioned. Sure. Well, and we see it as a utility, as a commodity to an extent, as we get past the initial growth phase of this part of the sharing economy. You know, we think of, which is also in our hometown, you know, San Antonio, Texas, Southwestern Bell, which is now AT&T, was headquartered in San Antonio. It's the biggest telecommunications business on the planet by an order of magnitude. And they got there not by attacking primary markets. They got there by locking up secondary and tertiary markets. And they got so big that they eventually were able to buy out their competitors. So I'm not suggesting that's our corporate strategy. What I am suggesting is that, like, there seems to be a lack of respect for the economic engine that exists inside of secondary and tertiary markets throughout the South.
Yeah.
And so, and they're also underserved from a transportation infrastructure perspective. You know, we do a lot of things really well in Texas, but one of the things we don't do well is building legacy transportation infrastructure. And that's because we have a very low tax, low regulation environment. And, you know, people don't want to vote for people who spend their taxpayer dollars building high-speed trains or even commuter trains or bike lanes or pedestrian access. So the deficiencies that we find in our public spaces in the South are actually much more pronounced than you find anywhere else, because these cities initially were designed around, you know, horse paths, but mostly around the automobile. And what we're seeing is, I kind of came into this with a, like, you know, parking congestion, traffic pollution, like, cool to deal with those things. And I mean that sincerely, for the record, just because I'm from Texas, I'm a very progressive person. Also, We don't want any misconceptions about my, hey man, my allegiances.
You don't have to do any more disclaimers. I trust you.
And then also knowing that the public sector isn't going to be able to allocate public dollars towards really addressing those first mile, last Absolutely. Mile solutions in a meaningful way. And that the private sector can come in and do that. And so it breaks down the partisan divide here, which is like liberals love it because they're like one side of it. And conservatives are like, whoa, the private sector can come in and innovate and address these problems in a way that is kind of elegant and efficient and from a more free market perspective. But we're not in a free market in the scooter space right now. There's so much cash in the space. There isn't a sense of market equilibrium yet. But I think what we're going to see over the course of the next few years really is kind of a fundamental rebalancing of not just urban spaces, but really of, you know, transportation sharing across platforms, being a part of not just Los Angeles, but being a part of places like Tyler, Texas, which no one's ever heard of. Like, that's materially different than we saw. And there are places that we're looking at as expansion markets that like don't even have Uber and Lyft yet, if that gives you a sense of the context around like the development cycle of new technology in seemingly rural, but areas that are populated with tens or hundreds of thousands of people and tens of thousands of college students. And they have the same issues with, you know, parking and traffic and congestion and getting to class or getting to work as anyone else does anywhere else. So, and you know, to do the like free market capitalist thing, like their Visa card, shout out Visa, charges just the same as anyone else's. So like customers are like just equal across the platform, but how you access them, how you cultivate them is kind of a we're trying to do that a little bit differently than some of the other folks in the space.
No, that's all brilliant, you know. And just to put this in perspective, right? Like, you know, you guys got an $18 million investment. This is public information. I hope. No, I'm just kidding. It is. I found it on the internet. It must be true.
Be careful.
And then another raise recently, because I think that kind of, for some, validates everything you just said. So I'm curious as to early on, right, when you started the company, what was that story you were telling when you were going to these investor conversations or even partners or employees? At some point, you're selling somebody ether, right? And then they go like, they have to believe some of the things that you know, and then you start to make those things true.
So I'm a philosophy major, so like I have no idea how we were able to impart that level of confidence in the investor community. By the way, that's inaccurate. So maybe on the internet or not, but it is inaccurate. The vast majority of our venture funding, both equity funding and venture debt facility, which we raised, is all from Texas right now. So that's a little different. Mm-hmm. Usually early big venture rounds aren't raised in cities like San Antonio, Texas. They're usually raised in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Santa Monica. Our story really was pretty simple, which is, you know, we didn't invent the crystal ball, but we did look inside of it and we did feel like that this was the next major point on the sharing economy timeline. We felt like rideshare was the first point. We feel like this is arguably the second, at least on the transportation sharing economy timeline. And we don't believe that this is the end point on it. We believe this is kind of a continuum that's happening. And knowing the kind of market comparables across sharing platforms gave us the ability to communicate that to investors in a way that I guess resonated and gave them confidence. And for us, it was a real, you know, gift without it being, I mean, I guess it was a gift, but with a lot of responsibility behind it, and kind of allowed us to go around and what I call, you know, collect what I think are like the baddest motherfuckers on the planet to come and work for me, because hardware is really hard. Software is doable. It's also hard. Integration between those two platforms is like maddeningly difficult for a philosophy major. But really, we just all have been all in on talent.
Yeah.
And we've had, you know, people, my chief business officer left a company with 65,000 employees to come run a startup, you know. We have people that we just got, and all of the people on my executive staff I've known for years. So it wasn't, it wasn't like a going and recruiting thing via LinkedIn. It was really being like, whoa, we have the luxury to build a world-class team and build world-class products and deliver them in a way that's differentiating ourselves from the kind of market leaders in the space. And if we can do that, we think we have a company that, you know, can be worth billions of dollars, and the market is kind of delivering that in the mechanism of results, top line revenue, and then also just pure growth. And so all that's born true. We're raising again, which is why we're out here in California. We've kind of actually, it's a sign of success and also a little point of, I don't know, discontent, which we've kind of like outgrown our ability to raise in Texas,
right,
from a venture standpoint. And that's different for us. That's different for startups in the South. And so we're just going to continue. We're going to continue raising. You know, this will be our last raise right now. We're raising another, you know, $30 million at a $300 million valuation. And then we're going to begin the process.
Hey, Eric, can you go get my backpack? No, I'm kidding. And then I'm in.
Yeah. And then the plan is though, after this round, we're going to go public because we think retail investors see this in the paper every day. They see it on the streets every day. We think it's a hyper growth industry. And even large family offices in Texas don't have access to venture rounds at Sequoia or whatever. So like the retail markets here are really interesting. The other thing we're trying to do, which is a little different, is we're trying to run a real business, like a business that makes money, not one that like hemorrhages cash all day long. I don't want to create any delusions like we're not hemorrhaging cash too. But
or unless there's some like tax thing that I don't know about, right? But it's, and not to veer off, but I think about the like when this idea of like fail hard, fail fast, like nobody really wants to do that. And maybe that's, I feel like that might be a coastal philosophy, to use a word that's in your world, of like, let's get in there and break things, where you're like, I want to do this right. Like I want to build a real company that functions well as often as possible.
The unit economics around scooters, if run appropriately, are a really sound business. Just purely the fees relating to a scooter that you can accrue in an area where you have the right number of them, and the subset cost of that scooter are and should be an 8x to 10x cash on cash return for every unit that you see on the streets. No one is experiencing those sorts of returns right now. And that's because there's so much capital in the space that people are literally, by people, I mean our competitors, are literally just buying equipment and throwing it at things.
Yeah.
Because the metrics are number of things on street, not number of things that are generating returns.
Well, we talked about that too, like in one of our earlier conversations, because that makes me think about companies like Ofo, right? Like out of China, and like the bikes are littered, like literally there's mountains of bikes because it was the same sort of model. But you talked a lot about the municipality, and even on your website, it talks a lot about the responsibility that you take in, you know, making sure that there's X number per population, keeping that ratio in harmony and not coming in and damaging like the aesthetics, you know, best case of the city, and if not like the sustainability of it.
So it's pretty easy to do and run a real business if you have a slightly controlled environment from a regulatory standpoint. If you have an open framework where anybody can come in and they can drop as much as they want with a low fee structure, you get an economic model where you're getting, you know, $1 to $2 per unit per day, which is not economic for anyone in the space, not even close to it. As we believe, and we're all seeing, most cities, big ones, medium-sized ones, and small ones, are running processes to have a limited number of providers, 2 or 3 or 4, sometimes a limited number of aggregate units throughout that city. And they're figuring out the fee structures that work for them to be able to deal with some of, we'll call it the litter or the clutter, the accumulation of private property in public spaces that didn't exist previously because dockless didn't exist at a global scale until, you know, 15 months ago, 16 months ago. But when you get into an environment where there is a sense of market equilibrium and some regulatory control, you can run a business that is one of the more dynamic businesses I've ever seen. I mean, if my investment advisor came to me and said, I can give you a 10x cash on cash return for the rest of your life, I would say, you're fired. that's impossible. Like, it can't be real. Right. In fact, like, no. But if run appropriately, this industry will see returns like that. And we haven't even begun the process of monetizing other verticals in the space, which two are very important. One, I guess they're both kind of obvious, and I'm a little bit remiss as to why I'm not hearing this talked about more, but it also is one of the things that's very much resonated with our institutional investors, is the data behind what we have from our users is like really powerful. We know a lot about you. We know like where you work, where you eat, who you hang out with, where you live. We have your credit card number. We have your driver's license. We have a lot of information. And what I'm saying is that information will be monetized at some juncture. People will find ways to do it, and they will find really elegant ways to do it, from push notifications through the process of you arriving at places and through incentive structures, and just through, you know, which is a reasonable seg to the other vertical, which we're working heavily on, and also why we're in Los Angeles, is advertising, which is, you know, we own tens of thousands of things that exist in public spaces. They are rolling billboards, and you know, people don't like the idea of it, but I can tell you advertisers love the idea of having tens of thousands of things out on the streets that people see and interact with, and all that stuff. And so figuring out how to capitalize across those takes those, you know, pretty incredible returns on the fee structure side of it, and turns us into an entirely different beast, which is where we get some of the inference or some of the suppositions about the potential for micromobility to be like maybe the dominant player in the sharing economy, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, going back to our, you know, initial conversation, we talked a lot about, like, even when the birds popped up of the world, and it was, the rumor was, it's a data play. Like, it's, you know, the things that we will learn about how people operate in a city or in a municipality, it's so key information, especially as we start to shift to smarter cities and the 5G, 6G even, conversation becomes, you know, where this is the early stages of being able to lay some other foundational work. So where do you see the expansion of not just the business, but the brand, right? If I can state it that way.
Sure. So we'll start with the business, which is, and this wasn't my idea, but it has been percolating. It's actually an idea from one of our investors, or at least an inference, which is, frankly, I don't even know if I'll be a scooter company 2 years from now. That's how quickly this is unfolding.
It could be a rollerblade company.
That would be fantastic. Electric rollerblades sound less safe than scooters. but I'm into it. I'll definitely do it.
Unicycles. Quick, order me 20,000 unicycles.
From the brand perspective, it's I'm kind of enamored with old legacy airline branding and also Texas history. So we're really trying to cultivate that sense of being a Texan company. You know, Blue Duck, for those folks who haven't read the Larry McMurtry novels or seen the miniseries Lonesome Dove in the 90s, was kind of the outlaw of that whole culture. And so what we're trying to do is kind of coalesce, you know, the Southwest Airlines motif around being a different player in a legacy industry, and tie that into like real Texas history in a way. And Blue Duck was like an actual guy. He was like an outlaw in the Old West. Like, you can look him up online, and he's a really interesting, you know, historical figure. So tying that in, enhancing it, you know, we just released our second generation scooter, which we're calling, you know, hashtag Maverick, for a variety of reasons. mostly because my name is right in the middle of that word, so like I need to make sure that all of our users know.
I see what, but I was like, what's this guy's name? I can't spell.
ask my staff. It's all about me all the time. Yeah.
Is that named Cooter?
So we spent a lot of time building, a lot of time. And a lot of time in this space is like, 10 minutes. But we spent, 4 months building, designing, and now delivering what we think is the finest piece of hardware on the planet by an order of magnitude, including, the market leaders. And the industry is catching up. Our first generation scooter was essentially a retrofitted thing you could buy at Walmart or Toys R Us and drop a box and put some GPS units and custom design a board and throw it out on the streets. And that wasn't sustainable from a business model perspective, nor was it the best way to do it. So as we've learned through this process, we've gotten to a point to where we're building much better, more robust hardware that has, almost double the battery capacity as the others, that is dramatically safer, that is heavier, that has all of its components that are internal. So there's no external facing anything that people can mess with. And we know that in a competitive environment, which some of our markets are, some of them aren't, we know that users care about hardware. We hear people saying, I choose, Lime over Bird or Bird over Lime because of most of the time the experience they have on the scooter. Do they feel safe on it? Are they accessible? Is the pricing comparable? And do they already have the app, or are they already integrated into that platform? And if you can check those boxes, you can build a really interesting business around that. So we're in the kind of the process of doing that and continuing to do that until we think we ultimately think this space will consolidate.
Yeah.
I don't know if it will consolidate down like rideshare did, to which is basically two dominant players. There's a reasonable case to be made that that's true. There's a reasonable case to be made that those two players, Uber and Lyft, will own this whole space.
Yeah.
And there's also a reasonable case to be made that it will be more decentralized, that pockets and areas and regional areas will have spheres of influence. If you're in, make up a city, Tuscaloosa, Alabama versus in Santa Monica, California. And so kind of working our way through that, we think go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because there's some thinking, at least in sort of, let's call it, in the retail space, right? Especially for delivered goods. And I did some studies on this. But looking at the consumer preference is not what we sometimes think in business. So sometimes it's like, is it going to be Guess or Diesel jeans? Whoever can get me the jeans faster, I'll pay the additional $70 if it means I can get them tomorrow, right? There's this convenience factor that goes into it. Or one of my a company I really love for something very specific is Under Armour, especially with their connected fitness platform, because they were like, we don't care if you use Fitbit or Jawbone or whatever, our platform is ubiquitous. So I'm wondering where's the, and maybe I'm extrapolating too far, but that app or that experience that goes I need a car. And it doesn't matter if it's Lyft or, or what's the one in Austin, Ride Austin, or whomever, what my convenience is expediency and ease. So thinking through that customer journey, and I don't know if I have a point there, but I think when you start to look at the Lyfts or the Limes versus the Birds, or where the consumer experience is going to evolve or change, or how are you guys approaching that?
What we're seeing right now, which may shift, but this is based off real data sets and reasonably large ones for us, is that if you're first to a market, you win. If you're second to a market, you equally win, meaning you kind of parse it out either 50-50 or 60-40 or some blend of those, depending on how many units you have and what your cost structure is. When you become third or fourth or fifth, it's not only not a good business, it's the worst business of all time. And what that tells us is that you have to be the first or second choice on someone's phone when you enter a new market, or you have to be the first or second choice on someone's phone when you get a license to operate in a market. Because those regulatory structures that the cities are passing, which are essentially municipal ordinances, which are giving people licenses to operate there, if you get one of those and you're one of two or one of three, it's a workable economic model.
Yeah.
But when you get past that, it becomes uneconomic. And what we see, particularly in markets, like one of our best markets where
Buster's Propane is in Corpus Christi. And we actually, like, Bird pulled out of there recently because they weren't able to really compete against us and Lime, who are also there. So that tells us that it's not just our data sets that are reaffirming that there's like a broader understanding of, you know, how you parse out these cities. Now, the real question is that does this consolidate on a like a national basis where there's just going to be a Coke and a Pepsi, or is it going to be more regional or even hyper local as to who the A player and the B player is? And so that's kind of where we're coming from at it right now. But it's also shifting, you know. And the good news is that I can thank our friends at Bird and Lime and their investors, because they just spent $1 billion educating the American consumer about scooter sharing platforms. Yeah. So there's like institutional knowledge in almost every city across the planet, what this is, how it works, why it should be there, and be more importantly, you know, why it should continue to be a part of the fabric of the community. And that was a threshold, which is this was so new and so disruptive. It did take time for, you know, regular folks, even regularly educated and progressive folks in places like California, to figure out like, how is this going to work from a user standpoint, from an operating standpoint, from a local government standpoint, and just from a like, how do we do simple things like try and make sure these things don't pile up in front of wheelchair ramps, you know, stuff like problems that just hadn't been material before, because there's so many more people that ride scooters on a daily basis than ride bicycles on a daily basis.
Right. So. No, I mean, it's the advantage of being a fast follower, right? You go, all right, I see you where this could be improved, especially, I mean, you know, I know you have a lot of relationships with like just municipal relationships and business relationships in San Antonio. We'll get into that in a second. Okay. But what I was going to ask is like, as far as entering a market, my Bird discovery, or my whole, which was my entry point to scooters, was like somebody told me about it, and I was like, he's like, oh, you haven't seen those scooters? I was like, no, because they were on the west side of town. I don't live there. A week later, I haven't not seen one starting that following week. Right? It was just kind of, so there was no advertising. Like, I mean, the device itself is, you know, in fact, an advertisement because the name's on it and somebody's scooting. You're like, oh, where's that from? And then there's all sorts of other ones. There's bikes now. There's all sorts of things. But when you look at the need to change people's behavior or become aware of this, you know, as a mode of transportation that's available in their city, how are you guys getting people, like, driving the adoption?
Really what we're trying to drive is the product itself. When you enter a new market, the product itself, adoption happens almost in kind of like a Fibonacci sequence over a matter of days.
You have to tell me what a Fibonacci sequence
is. It's a mathematical equation. Yeah, it's basically a number. It's spiral theory. So it's essentially an exponential curve, right? So day one, you know, people see it. Day two, they see it too. Day three, like, people are using it. Day four, like, twice as many people are using it. And that goes up. Eventually, it doesn't continue forever, obviously. Right. But eventually you reach kind of a plateau of what market equilibrium looks like. Sure. And it's pretty quickly. We see it within like 14 to 17 days is about what we plan for to get a market to a place to where it is economic on a daily basis for us to be putting equipment out every day. What we're really trying to stay focused on, because we do care, is trying to help users, riders, be better users of the technology, you know? And that simply is that we believe that phone, keys, wallet in 10 years will be phone, keys, wallet, helmet. We think helmets will be a part of day-to-day living for people who live in urban spaces. And that's going to take a revolution in helmet technology for that to happen. And part of the reason people don't wear helmets is vanity, myself notwithstanding, because my hair is not extra good. But the other part is,
I've seen pictures of you with longer hair.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I grew it out so I could raise that big round. I felt like it made investors more comfortable.
Yes.
If I had purple sunglasses and a purple swimsuit on and long hair. For sure. But we think one of the big problems with helmets, and there's a couple of people who are addressing them, a couple of companies that are addressing them, is people don't want to put something that's the size of a bowling ball in their backpack and take it to work.
Yeah.
So collapsible, safe helmets that you can integrate into your DSF is
collapsible.
I mean, like things
that are. Oh, I got a new collapsible helmet. You guys want to go for a ride?
I mean, look, no. I'm not.
I'm teasing. I get it.
Like, clearly, I'm not an athlete. But like, how many times do you see somebody put a basketball in their backpack in the morning? Like, it's just not a thing, you know.
True.
And so we think that over the course of time and over the course of people understanding, which cyclists have. Because most dedicated cyclists, at least where we live, a helmet is a part of their life, right? Mm-hmm. But that took time for that to happen. So we expect it to take some time for users to kind of adopt to that. And it's going to take, you know, the creative energy of, you know, people smarter than myself to design helmets that can really integrate them into your day-to-day life if you want to use it as a commodity. By that, I mean, like my sister who lives here in LA just decided not, for the first time in her adult life, to not buy a car. She's going carless, which maybe is a thing out here at home. It's absurd. Like, no one would do that at home. But when you do that,
50-50 split.
You have to be like, okay, well, how am I going to do that? Which means like, she works at Warner. She carpools a couple of days a week with her coworkers.
Right.
She Ubers a lot. She uses scooters a lot. She walks a lot. If she needs one, maybe she rents one. And it's not really an experiment. It's the fact is that owning even inexpensive, but certainly expensive automobiles from a cost return perspective, like, probably doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And so finding ways to help users of scooters be safer throughout those platforms is going to be value accretive to everyone, the companies, the users, the cities. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to make our insurance rates go down, which insurance for us is like staggeringly expensive in this space in a way that like makes no sense, because incident rates are actually, comparatively speaking, to bicycling, to driving in a car, or to even just walking down the sidewalk, incident rates are like actually pretty low on an aggregate basis. But just because they're low doesn't mean you can't do things as an industry to help people be safer. I mean, the seatbelt didn't exist until Ralph Nader decided to make it so. You know, cars were around a long time before people were in a matter where automobile accidents almost all the time were fatal. And so the world's a much better place because of it. So we're going to try and do some things and partner with some companies that can help users be safer if they want to. By the way, we don't need you to wear a helmet if you don't want to. We're just saying, like, we think it's a good idea. If you're going to be on a motorized device on a sidewalk going to work every day, and we can find a helmet that'll fit in your bag that you can use effectively.
Inflatable sweatband. That's my contribution to your business right now.
A sweatband that has an airbag in it.
Yeah. Just a quick little burst.
It'd be a killer party trick.
You got to fall very. You have to be very strategic in how you fall, but.
No, I just love to use that at a party to just walk in and be like, boom.
Exactly.
My head just exploded. This party is so, so lit right now.
Yeah. You have a lot of, speaking of heads, you have a lot of stuff in yours. As far as like the data, the information, the cultural relevancy, the future of it, the impact from a, you know, just understanding the future of micromobility. Use your word, though you can't ugh me. What was your learning curve coming into this? Because obviously this business did not exist as in this stage. So like, what were you doing 3 years ago? You're like, scooters, I got it.
So I'll go back to the back. I went to Cambridge Elementary.
Oh, cool. That's where you studied philosophy.
It didn't do well. It wasn't good. Yeah. Socially or from an educational standpoint. No, I was running my family venture capital and private equity office for several years. Still do, but in case anyone's out there, don't send us deals. I don't have time to look at them. But eventually, when this is all over, I will be looking at them again. I did some work in the energy space. Particularly, we did some takeovers of publicly traded companies, which was really interesting and really fun in the downturn. The energy downturn of 2014. I've started a few nonprofits. I started a think tank with the current mayor of San Antonio to really bring credit.
What's the mayor's name?
His name's Ron Nuremberg.
Yes.
He was a bodybuilder
and also ran a jazz radio station and is a brilliant guy and he's doing really good things. But he and I got together when he was a city council person, started this kind of policy think tank, wonky thing.
Was it Think SA?
Think SA, yeah. To really get people, not just talking, but like getting actionable ideas to address like transportation, education, water, you know, and, you know, just generally technology related issues in cities that aren't like heavy tech, where there's like a heavy tech ecosystem where that's already built into the fabric of the decision-making process. And then as I told you, I played in a band called National Parks, which was a jazz folk electronic kind of group that toured a good bit several years ago. And, you know, I used to write for Relics magazine as a music writer in college. I worked for the String Cheese Incident in college.
By the way, I'm having trouble placing this genre of music. Jazz, folk, electronic.
So I had like a really incredible folk musician named Josh Glenn. I hope he hears this. And I was a trained jazz and classical guitarist. And I understand economics a little bit, and being a classical or jazz musician is like not great. So I was like, how do we take this like institutional knowledge and turn it into something that's more modern? So I started running my rig into a whole series of computers and Ableton Live systems and doing lots of kind of like Nels Kleiny, Wilco-y, like texturing, atmosphere stuff.
You had an inventive spirit for a while,
it's a compliment. It's a boy, is it a burden too? Let me tell you.
I mean, look, if LCD sound system can do it, you can too.
So what we would do is he would play traditional folk music, I would take electronic music. And what we did was completely free form. So we would play shows that there weren't any songs, kind of in, you know, the manner of you saw some of the like krautrock bands originally. Mm-hmm. And then we would play shows like on Bill Murray's birthday, we would tease songs from his movies in and out with our catalog all night and never stop and call samples and do stuff. So by jazz, don't tell Wynton Marsalis that I'm a jazz musician, and he'd be like extra upset. But by jazz, I mean like heavy improv, heavy, like deep space kind of stuff that we were hoping, because we never had delusions about selling records. Please don't go listen to our records. They're not good.
I think it's too late for that.
But, but we did.
Natural Parks, ladies and gentlemen. National Parks. Because they already messed it up.
We definitely could like get in a room and feel it hit, and it was hitting because each of those experiences was unique. Every show was different. Everything was different. And there was like a sense of kind of freedom and I hope like happiness or joy into it. And so our expectation as to how you could turn that into a business was to create like these platforms where people could come into a room without like knowing it was Bill Murray's birthday,
right?
And walk out of there, you know, with a sense of appreciation for him, and hopefully maybe in a, like a limited capacity, the fact that we were able to like somehow weave the stuff together and make a human moment out of it.
Well, what I love about that, and you know, is I think in the jazz construct, let's call it that, so we won't upset Winston.
Marcelo. He's so upset about people who don't play traditional jazz. I love him. He's phenomenal.
There's something like more so than, and this is my like rudimentary opinion, more so than most genres of music, there's something about connectiveness in that. When you're like freestyling, that person's freestyling, you're freestyling, like we're all giving each other space and room, but we're creating one cohesive vision. You know, I would imagine that philosophy goes into how you build a company. Which my segue is that I was curious, where does philosophy come into how you operate as a business leader?
So I try not to think about it. I mean, I spent a lot of time.
Isn't that what philosophy is? You don't think about it.
You have to think like really hard. It's like music. You got to think really hard about it and then like try and forget all of it. Really, it's more, I actually have taken from a corporate culture and a leadership dynamic, I've really taken more from my musical career, which is I think about my executive team like a band. And I think about it in the context of You know, each person has a role to play. And when we go into a room, whether it's to pitch a mayor or a city manager, or we go into a room to pitch a fund manager, there isn't really a rubric. It is jazz music. You have to know each other. You have to know each other at a level which is not really intimate, but in a manner which is like so thorough that you know what they're going to say before they're going to say it. So you can craft a collective narrative about what you're trying to do, which can create, you know, we'll call it a song in this context, which resonates with your audience. And so I also hope, and this is like completely wishful thinking, but I'm going to try and do it. We believe, you know, that at least us, there will be a point in my life when I'm not in the scooter business. I tease that like the first line in my obituary, maybe the second line in my obituary right now includes the word scooter, which is like kind of dumb. And, but it, I thought it was dumb at first. Now I have like an immense amount of pride around that, because I think what we're doing collectively and as an industry is maybe one of the more important innovations that's happened in a century. So knowing that, it's just like, I used to like buy Razor scooters at Toys R Us, right? Yeah. So like knowing that I'm like somehow related to that industry is a little bit weird, but I feel like eventually, hopefully, there will be a time when I get to go do other stuff.
Yeah.
And my band, my team that I have right now, is not industry specific, kind of as mentioned earlier. And I want to like take them with me. That's like, I didn't build them to be a scooter company. I built them to be like the best team in the world. No, and we want to go do other stuff
like
too.
The Avengers, like whatever the mission whatever is at is, the moment. Like that's what we're good at.
We'll call it the Coastal Cowboys or something.
You just did it. Coastal Cowboy Ventures.
Warner Brothers. You can call me on that one. I'm ready.
You should get Lil Nas X to sign on as your artist in residence. If you ever heard Old Town Road with him and Billy Ray Cyrus, I highly recommend it.
I didn't fully answer your question though. The philosophy part was really important, and it was more important not from a content perspective, but that stuff's interesting too. It was really more important from like a mentorship perspective. Mm. My professors and kind of the people that I interacted with through those departments were really formative in critical thinking, problem solving, and reading and writing, which now everybody is like kind of heavy STEM. That's the only way to go if you want your kid to be successful. And I think there's a lot of data that suggests that true, but not at the expense of, you know, the humanities fields, which in my case have been incredibly valuable to my career. So I'm not trying to discount, like, don't tell your kid to not go to engineering school because he needs to, you know, be a lawyer or something. I'm just saying, like, if you've got people in your system who are yearning for that sense of kind of like a more, you know, humanity driven development, don't dissuade them, because I was really lucky and my parents were basically like, when you go to school, we don't care what you do. We just want you to go to school and we want you to do stuff that's interesting to you, because we're worried if you're doing stuff that isn't interesting to you, you're not going to enjoy it and you're not going to do it. You're going to do something else and it's going to be detrimental. And so in my case, I just got into a pipeline where I really enjoyed, you know, heavy humanities, and it's been hugely beneficial. So, I'm grateful for it. And I reference it all the time. Unfortunately, we live in like a borderline post-literate society. So when I reference it, I just see him like that guy who's like in the back of the room, saying weird shit.
Differently, you know, like, than it did, you know, like, I mean, I have a book on Socrates at home that, you know, and I have two kids. So I'm like,
have you read it? No, I definitely read it.
From it. I don't know if I read it, but I think, like everything else, it's evolved in a way where, like, Instagram quotes, right? Like, it's not the full story. You need to really understand the humanities from the level of study, but the constant just sort of nudge, like in a feed where you're like, oh yeah, I did need to hear that message, or that is true, or whatever the thing is. I think it's just changed shape.
It was, I mean, I'll be full disclosure, it like was limiting to an extent. I graduated from college in 2007.
as a philosophy major, which, like, let's just be honest, like, the world wasn't exactly, like, yearning for my professional skills, right? So, which is, like, totally fine. Basically, people were like, are you going to law school? Are you going to business school? Are you going to wait tables at a restaurant? And I was like, I don't think any of those are a good idea right now. So I'm going to go do some other stuff too in the interim. But that is the one kind of, at least to me, one of the limiting factors is it was a bridge.
Yeah.
To where we are today. It's hugely influential to me personally. I don't touch a lot of it anymore.
Yeah.
Meaning I still have, like, the relics of the material and stuff, but just like whatever learning scales or learning, you know, traditional Gershwin standards or whatever, it stays with you over time in a manner that's not necessarily directly correlated with what you're doing.
Yeah. So. No, it was. And I find that a lot of innovators are Renaissance people in their own right. Like, they have multiple inputs, whether it's music, philosophy, energy, venture capital, and now, you know, scooters and Buster's propane. So it's and you know, for me, it was engineering, comedy, you know, writing, marketing, but and then eventually it culminates into a very unique perspective on how the world should operate. With that, you've seen a lot of things.
I'm not that old. Do I look old?
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
This business has aged me so much. It's, I was like, unbelievable.
Did you say 2007 or 1977? no, you look fine. I look old. But with that, what have you seen outside of your own business, you know, in the world, maybe just on your trip here or elsewhere, that you currently have an innovation crush on?
You know, I'm so myopic right now. I have things I want to do that are outside of this that aren't really based off my experiences of what other people are doing, just things that I think would be really interesting businesses. But I don't have the time for it. And so it's not for a lack of yearning, it's just for a lack of bandwidth, really. And so in that sense,
I mean, it could be something you've observed. It doesn't have anything you, like, are personally involved
in. It's just hard. I mean, it's fun to talk about this stuff, but, like, I can't overstate, like, this industry, this business, at least for me, and I can't speak for Travis or any of the other CEOs at their companies, but this is not recommended for people. Like, it's like 100 hours a week we work. It's not good for your brain. It's not good for, like, your personal relationships. It's not good for, like, maintaining friendships. It's all consuming because it has to be, because there's no platform where you can't be completely kind of all in on this right now. But in that context, there's still, like, a lot of other stuff I want to do that I have. It's not an ideas book. It's just, like, things that I think are interesting, and I'm not saying what they are right now, but I hope to be able to get there in the distant future. So in that
context, what gratification do you get out of this, right? Like, if the 100-hour weeks are taken away from, like you said, brain power, stress, family, et cetera, you know, and Alexis Ohanian has become a big advocate for, like, founder mindfulness, right? Like, the whole long work week porn that we all subscribe to may not actually be necessary or healthy, which you just kind of said on your own. But where do you find, like, your joy? Because you seem like a pretty well put together guy. I mean, this ensemble is interesting, but as far as your spirit is intact. So, like, how do you bridge the gap between those?
Yeah, I just assume I'm going to do the business school thing first. I haven't been to, but I don't know. We can just do, they probably teach this somewhere. Like, if you're making an impact, which transportation sharing is reforming American and global cities. That's huge. If you're enjoying doing it, that's, like, a plus. And if you're able to do it with people who are world-class, and if you have to spend 100 hours a week doing stuff, you're around some of the most brilliant people you can find, it's incredibly rewarding. Right. That would be the business school answer. The real answer is, you know, I, and this is going to sound, I'm,
like self-professed a little bit arrogant. And I'm like, whatever, acceptance is the first step. I don't know what the other steps are. I'm told there are steps, but I'm like accepting of that. And like, I don't have to work. Like, I'm not doing this for some sort of an exit. Like, this isn't about like building a big mausoleum somewhere or something. Like, I don't care. I just like to do stuff and to build things and to do it with incredible human beings. And when you do that, it's one of the more rewarding things that I'm aware of, at least that I've experienced. And despite the internal and personal consequences of it, it's inescapable once you get into a pipeline like that. Like, I can't imagine just going to some job and then, like, staring at the clock. And like, I just wouldn't do it. I would just go do something else, right? And so, but this is like, for me, like a landmark moment in our generation.
Absolutely.
From a human standpoint and also from a technology standpoint, that feels like it's worth the sacrifice to do it. So,
well stated. All right, breathe this entire conversation in. Whew. A lot of good nuggets here, but finish this phrase for me. Innovation to me is
indescribable for me. In the sense of innovation is a continuum of progress. And it is a massive net positive across economic thresholds, cultural thresholds, social thresholds, and political ones. And if you can bind those together, which we are in this industry collectively, you're in a pretty good space. I do want to put like a quick pin in this, which is I lost my voice yesterday. I don't actually sound like this.
Sounds sexy to me.
I'm not trying to do some sort of like an Elizabeth Holmes impersonation, although she's great.
Is she though?
And I'm also like with an immense amount of love and adoration for the legend Diane Rehm. I'm not trying to recreate her vocal career either. So if you're hearing this, I realize I do sound like a jazz singer, and that's unintentional. I sound much worse, you know, most days, although it is a bit out of character.
Well, thank you for the disclaimer. I'm glad the audience will now know
I'm not Elizabeth Holmes.
This you're not Elizabeth. Exactly.
That's assuming it is an affectation for her. I don't think we know that yet. So
it's still yet to be determined. Well, thank you. Where can people find out more about Blue Duck? You like, where's the
Fly Blue Duck cross handles? We're in South Texas. Come see us. Hit us on social. Hit our scooters, man. I'm not joking around. People talk about having great hardware. Our hardware is unbelievable. I'm so proud of it. And, you know, all we care about is, you know, building a business that is about creating great user experiences, which that's goes back to your point about innovation. You can do that, be able to build incredible businesses. So that's exactly what we're going to keep doing for the foreseeable future.
Well, thank you. Everyone, this has been another amazing episode of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.